sign in, have his face confirmed against the photograph, then sign out at Lower Thames Street. His every night journey recorded. For the first and only time in his life, he was in the books. He, who had been so proud of not appearing in that encyclopedic manual listing dog track criminals. 3 journeys a night from the gunpowder mills, back and forth, when most of the east end of the city was asleep and unaware of the existence and danger of what was happening on night roads. But always recorded. So now, these years later, in that room of hanging maps, I was able to find the marked-up routes, aware how similar the journeys were to those we had taken those nights from the East End, from somewhere near Limehouse Basin to the centre of the city. I stood in the empty map room, the banners swaying as if touched by a sudden breeze. I knew somewhere there would be a file on all the drivers. I remembered him still only as the Pimlico Data, but along with a passport-sized photograph would be his real name. In an adjacent room, I pulled open cabinet drawers, looking at index cards of black-and-white photographs of gaunt men still in their youth, until there was the name I had not remembered, beside a face I did. Norman Marshall. My Data. Norman! I now recalled the moth yelling in our crowded living room in Ruvigny Gardens. It was a 15-year-old picture of him, with, somehow obsessively beside it, his updated address. Here was the Data. There would be a lit cigarette in his left hand, resting on the wheel as he swerved those corners, his right elbow on the open window frame, so his arm was wet from the harsh rain that was keeping him alert. There was no company to talk to on those nights, and he was no doubt singing that old song to stay awake, about a dame who was known as the Flame. Our heroes do not usually, after a certain age, teach or guide us anymore. They choose instead to protect the last territory where they find themselves. Adventurous thought is replaced with almost invisible needs. Those who once mocked the traditions they fought against with laughter now provide only the laughter, not the mockery. Was this what I came to believe about the Data the last time I saw him? After I had become an adult? I'm still not sure. I now had an address for where he was, and went to see him. But during that final meeting, I could not tell if he was simply uninterested in me, or whether there was a hurt or an anger towards me. I had, after all, upped and left his world suddenly years ago. And now here I was, no longer that boy. And while I remembered my adventures with him during that confused and vivid dream of my youth, the Data would not speak of the past as I wished him to do. I had wanted to catch up on all of them, but he kept steering me back to the present. What was I doing now? Where did I live? Was I? So all that I could really do was interpret the visit by recognizing the conversational barriers he set up. Just as I noticed that he seemed obsessively careful of where things existed and needed to remain in his kitchen. So if I picked up something, for instance a glass, a coaster, he recalled where it had to be returned to. He had not been expecting me to arrive at his door that day, at that hour. In fact, had not been expecting me at all. So the order in his flat was clearly an everyday habit. Whereas my memory of the Data, which I admit may have become exaggerated over the years, was of a man around whom things got lost or fell to pieces. But here was a welcome mat on which you needed to brush the soles of your shoes before entering, a neatly folded tea towel, and down the hall, 2 doors that I saw him carefully close as we walked back to the kitchen to put on the kettle. I was living a solitary life, so I recognized solitary as well as the small dimensions of order that come with that. The Data was not solitary. He had a family now. A wife named Sophie, he said, and a daughter. This surprised me. I tried to guess which of his paramours had ensnared him, or had been ensnared by him. Surely not the argumentative Russian. In any case, that afternoon he was alone in the flat, and I did not meet Sophie. The fact that he was married and had a child was as far back as he would go in speaking of the past. He refused to talk about the war, and brushed off my laughing questions about the dog trade. He said he remembered little of that time. I asked if he had seen the program Olive Lawrence had done for the BBC. "No," he said quietly. "I missed it." I did not want to believe him. I hoped he was just continuing to be evasive. I could forgive that. That he had not forgotten, but had shut her out of his life as well, rather than that he could not be bothered to turn on a television. Or perhaps I was the only one left who remembered those times, those lives. And so he kept placing obstacles on the road back to our past that wouldn't allow me to reach it, though he could see that was why I had come. He seemed nervous, too. I wondered at first if he assumed I was judging whether he had done well or had made a disappointing choice in life. I watched him pour tea into each of our cups. I heard from someone that Agnes had a difficult time. I tried to find her, but couldn't. "I think we all went our own way," he said. "I'll move to the Midlands for a while. I could be a new face there, if you know what I mean. Someone without a past." I remember those nights with you on the barge, with the dogs, most of all.
"Do you? Is that what you remember most?"
"Yes." He raised his cup in a silent, ironic toast. He would not return to those years.
"So how long are you here? What'd you do with yourself?"
It felt to me that both questions, side by side, showed a lack of interest. So I told him without too much detail where I was living, what I did. I invented something for Rachel. Why did I lie? It may have just been the way he asked me, as if all the questions were insignificant. He appeared to want nothing from me.
"Do you still import things?" I asked.
He waved the remark away.
"Oh, I go up to Birmingham once a week. I'm older, not travelling much now, and Sophie works in London."
He stopped there. His hand smoothed the tablecloth, and I got up eventually, after too much silence from the man whose company I had at one time grown to love, after first disliking him and then fearing him. I thought I had experienced every aspect of him. The roughness, then the generosity. So it was difficult now to see him so static, to have every sentence of mine swept cleverly away to a dead end.
"I should go." "All right, Nathaniel."
I asked if I could use his bathroom for a moment and went down the narrow hall. I looked at my face in his mirror, no longer the boy who had traveled with him on those midnight roads, whose sister he had once helped save from an attack. I turned around in that small space, as if the room had an unbroken seal, was the only place that might reveal something more of my wild, unreliable hero from the past, my teacher. I tried to imagine what kind of woman he had married. I picked up the three toothbrushes on the edge of the sink and balanced them on my palm. I touched and smelled his shaving soap on the shelf. I saw three folded towels. Sophie, whoever she was, had brought order to his life. All this was surprising to me. All this was sad. He'd been an adventurer, and now I stood there, claustrophobic within his life. How calm and content he had appeared, pouring the tea, stroking the tablecloth. He, who was always taking bites out of other people's sandwiches while rushing to some questionable meeting, excitedly picking up someone's dropped playing card on a street or waterfront, tossing the peel from a banana over his shoulder into the back seat of the Morris where Rachel and I sat with the dogs. I went out into the narrow hall and looked for a while at a framed piece of cloth embroidered with words. I don't know how long I stood there, looking at it, reading it, and rereading it. I put my fingers on it, then pulled myself away, and very slowly walked to the kitchen, as if this was certain to be the last time I was here. At the front door of the Darter's flat, about to leave, I turned to say, "Thanks for the tea." I was still not sure what to call him. I had never called him by his real name. The Darter nodded with a precise smile, enough of a smile so as not to appear rude or angry with me for invading his privacy, then closed the door on me. I was miles away, caught up in the noise of the train back to Suffolk, before I allowed myself to gather our lives through the prism of that afternoon visit. There had been no attempt to forgive or punish me. It was worse. He did not wish me in any way to understand what I had done with my quick and unwarned disappearance those years ago. What led me to understand what had taken place in his flat was remembering what a great liar the Darter was. How, when surprised by a policeman or security guard at a warehouse or museum, he would improvise an unplanned lie that was so intricate and even so ridiculous that he would be laughing at it himself. People did not usually lie and find it funny at the same time. That was his disguise.
"Never plan a lie," he told me during one of those night journeys. "Invent as you go along. It's more believable."
The famous counterpunch. And the way he always breasted his cards. The Darter had poured the tea so calmly, while his mind and heart must have been on fire. He barely looked at me as he spoke. He watched only the thin stream of ochre-coloured tea. There was always care in Agnes for those around her. This is what I remembered most about her. She could be loud, argumentative, tender with her parents. She clutched at all aspects of the world, but there was care. She had drawn the little portrait of us at our meal, then double-folded the butcher paper, so it was contained in what looked like a frame, and put it in my pocket. That is how she would hand over a gift, even something as worthless, as priceless as that, saying,
"Here, Nathaniel, for you."
And I, who was still a naive, coarse 15-year-old, had received it and kept it in silence. We are foolish as teenagers. We say wrong things, do not know how to be modest or less shy. We judge easily. But the only hope given us, although only in retrospect, is that we change. We learn, we evolve. What I am now was formed by whatever happened to me then, not by what I have achieved, but by how I got here. But who did I hurt to get here? Who guided me to something better, or accepted the few small things I was competent at? Who taught me to laugh as I lied? And who was it made me hesitate about what I had come to believe about the moth? Who made me move from just an interest in characters to what they would do to others? But above all, most of all, how much damage did I do? There had been a closed door ahead of me as I stepped from the Darter's bathroom. Beside it, on the wall, was a framed piece of cloth with an embroidered blue sentence. "I used often to lie awake through the whole night, and wish for a large pearl." Below it, stitched with thread of a different colour, was a birth date, with the month and the year. 13 years ago. There was no reason why the data should have known that a piece of embroidered cloth would give it away. Sophie, his wife, had made it for herself and the child. It was something she used to say to herself before she fell asleep. I remember. She probably would not even recall she had said the line to me once, or if she still remembered that night when we talked to each other in the darkness of that borrowed house. Even I have forgotten it until now. Besides, she would never have assumed I would appear one afternoon in her home and see that wish of hers so evident on the wall. And now, a landslide from a simple stitched sentence. I did not know what to do. Hers had been the story I never followed. How could I travel back through time to Agnes of Battersea, to Agnes of Limeburner's Yard, where she'd lost that cocktail dress, to Agnes and Pearl of Mill Hill? If a wound is great, you cannot turn it into something that is spoken. It can barely be written. I know where they live now, on a treeless street. I need to be there at night and yell her name out so she can hear it, her eyes opening silently from sleep, and sit up in the darkness.
"What is it?"
he will say to her.
"I heard..."
"What?"
"I don't know. Go to sleep." "I suppose so. No, there it is again."
I keep calling and wait for her response. I had not been told anything, but like my sister with her theatrical inventions or Olive Lawrence, I know how to fill in a story from a grain of sand or a fragment of discovered truth. In retrospect, the grains of sand had always been there. The fact that no one had spoken to me of Agnes when I assumed they might have. The now understandable cold-blooded silence of the data in his flat towards me. And the folded towels. She had, after all, been a waitress, a washer and cleaner like me in various kitchens, and lived in a small council flat where neatness was a necessity. The data must have been amazed by such rules and beliefs in a pregnant 17-year-old girl who would go on to cordon off the bad habits of his life so efficiently. I imagine the two of them. With what? Envy? Relief? Guilt that I had not known what I was responsible for till now? I thought how they must have judged me. Or was I the unspoken subject, in much the way the data had responded to Olive Lawrence's television program, as well as her book that he had never picked up. A dismissal of us all. He didn't have time now. He needed to travel to the Midlands once a week. There was a child to raise. The times were sparse and hard. A few weeks after Agnes discovered she was pregnant, and with no one else she felt able to speak to about it, she had taken one bus, then another, and got off near the Pelican Stairs, where the data lived. She had not seen me for over a month, and assumed that was where I was. It was dinner time. There was no answer at the door, so she sat on the steps while the street darkened around her. When he did return home, she was asleep. He touched her awake. She didn't know where she was, then recognized my father. So that upstairs, when she told him her situation, not knowing where I was or where I had gone to, the data had needed to confess another truth as to who he really was and the way he really knew me and where I might have gone or been taken. They sat there all night in his narrow flat beside a gas fire. It was like a confessional. And during and after the several repeated and circular conversations to calm her disbelief, Did he tell her what he did? What his profession was? A short while ago, I saw an old film revived in a cinema where the central character, an innocent man, is wrongly convicted and his life ruined. He escapes from a chain gang, but will be forever on the run. In the last scene of the film, he meets the woman he loved in his earlier life, but can be with her only briefly, knowing he is in danger of being caught. As he steps back, away from her into the darkness, she cries out, "How do you live?" And our hero, played by Paul Muni, says, "I steal." And with that last sentence, the movie ends, and the film darkens, closing on his face. When I saw that film, I thought of Agnes and the data, and wondered when and how she had discovered the illegality of what he did. How she had dealt with this knowledge of her husband's insecure criminality in their life together, in order that they could survive. Everything I remembered about Agnes, I still loved. She had pulled me out from my youthful privacy by making me so fully aware of her. But she also was the most truthful person I knew. She and I had broken into houses, stolen food from the restaurants we worked in. But we were harmless. She argued at dishonesty or unfairness. She was truthful. You did not damage others. What a wondrous code to already have at that age. So I thought of Agnes and this man she had liked so much, the one she believed was my father. When and how did she discover what he did? There are so many questions I want answered by some version of the truth. How do you live? I steal. Or did he keep that from her a little longer, until another meeting on another night in that narrow Pelican Stairs flat? One solution, one resolution at a time. First this, and then that. And only afterwards would he say what he was willing to do. And it was no longer one of those moments in a love song he hummed to himself, about how everything occurred spontaneously through quick cause and effect, so that one fell in love while down by the shore an orchestra was playing. No longer the simplicity of coincidence, happenstance. There was, I knew, a great affection between them. They had that to go forward with, alongside their different ages and suddenly different roles. There was no one else, in any case. He had assumed he would always be independent and gateless. He felt he knew the intricacies of women. He may have even told me, earlier, that his numerous suspect professions were to affirm his independence and lack of innocence to others. So now, as he simultaneously attempted to calm her, to make her understand the less innocent, less truthful world, he needed in some way to bring her out from her focused, self-defeating self. Were there many conversations before he suggested marriage? He knew she needed to be aware of what he really did, before she could make a decision. It must have shocked her, not because he might be taking advantage of her, but because of something more surprising. He was offering a safe path out of the closing world she was in. She moved with him into a small flat. There was no money for anything larger. No, I suspect they did not think of me, or judge me or dismiss me. That is my sentiment from a distance. They were in a busy life, where each farthing mattered, where every tube of toothpaste was bought at a specific price. What was happening to them was the real story, while I still existed only in the maze of my mother's life. They were married in a church. Agnes, / Sophie, wished for a church. A clutch of associates were there, along with her parents and her estate agent brother. One girl from work, a couple of lifters he used on jobs, the forger of Letchworth, who was his best man, as well as the merchant who owned the barge. Agnes had insisted on him. The parents, then, and 6 or 7 others. She needed to find another job. Her co-workers at the restaurant were unaware she was expecting a child. She bought newspapers and looked through the classifieds. Through a contact of the Darters from that earlier time, she found work at Waltham Abbey, which was re-emerging now during the post-war years as a research center. It was where she'd once been happy. She knew its history, had read all those pamphlets on our borrowed barge, as we moved silently beneath loud bird calls, or rose slowly within the locks of those canals, dug during the previous century, to connect the Abbey's source of weapons to the arsenals along the Thames at Woolwich and Purfleet. A bus took her past Holloway Prison, along Seven Sisters Road, and let her off at the grounds of the Abbey. She was back in that same rural landscape where she had once been with the Darter and me. Her life had become circular. She worked at one of the long tables in the airless, cavern-like rooms in East Wing A, 200 women focusing only on what was in front of them, never pausing. No one spoke. They sat on stools too far away from one another for conversation. Apart from the noise made by the movement of their hands, there was silence. What was this like for Agnes, so used to laughter and argument while she worked? She missed the chaos of those kitchens, unable to talk, get up and look from a window, tethered instead to the speed of an unhesitating conveyor belt. They changed locations on alternate days. One day in the East Wing, the next day in the West. Always wearing protective goggles, measuring the ounces of explosive on a scale, spooning it into the containers that slid by. Grains of it were caught under her fingernails, disappeared into her pockets, into her hair. It was worse in the West Wing, where they worked with the yellow crystals of tetryl, packing it into a pill form. The stickiness from the explosive crystals remained on their hands and turned them yellow. Those who worked with tetryl were known as the canaries. Lunch hours allowed conversation, but the cafeteria was another enclosed space. She took her packed lunch and walked south to the woods she remembered, ate her sandwich by the riverbank. She lay on her back, exposing her belly to the sunlight. She and the baby alone in this universe. She listened for a bird or the movement from a bush stirred by wind, some alarm of life. She walked back to the West Wing, yellow hands in her pockets. She did not know what really took place in the strangely shaped structures she passed, where steps disappeared underground into climatic chambers, built to test new weapons in desert heat or Arctic conditions. There was barely evidence of human activity. On a hill, in the distance, was the great nitrator, in which nitroglycerin had been made for over 2 centuries. Beside it, underground, were its immense wash pools. Accessing the old files in the archives had given me knowledge of the half-buried buildings that Agnes would have walked beside when pregnant with Pearl. I knew now what all those buildings and landmarks at Waltham Abbey had been used for. He knew that even the seemingly innocent forest pool, into which Agnes, at the age of 17, had leapt, was where underwater cameras had been set up to measure the power and effect of explosives that would later bomb the Ruhr Valley dams in Germany. That 40-foot-deep pool, where Barnes Wallace and A.R. Collins tested their bouncing bomb, was where she had surfaced, shivering and breathless, then climbed onto the deck of the muscle boats and shared her old cigarettes with the Darter. At 6 in the evening, she walks out from the gates of Waltham Abbey and catches a bus back to the city. She leans her head against the window, her eyes gazing over the Tottenham marshes, her face darkening as the bus passes under the bridge at St. Anne's Road. Norman Marshall is there in the flat when she returns. her pregnant body exhausted as she passes him without letting him touch her.
I feel filthy. Let me wash first.
She hunches over the sink and pours water from a bowl onto her head to remove the gunpowder grains from her hair, then frantically scrubs her hands and arms up to the elbows. The gum-like filling used to pack cartridges into boxes and the tetryl have attached themselves to her like tree resin. Again and again, Agnes washes her arms and as much of the skin on her body as she can reach. Nowadays, I eat at the hour the greyhound does. And in the evening, when he feels ready for sleep, he will drift silently to the table where I work and lower his tired head onto my hand in order to stop me. I know this is for comfort, needing something warm and human for security, a faith in another. He comes to me even with all my separateness and uncertainties. But I too wait for this, as if he might wish to tell me about his haphazard life, a past I do not know. All the unrevealed needfulness that must be in him. So I have the dog beside me, who needs my hand. I am in my walled garden, that is in every way still the Malachite's garden, with now and then a surprise of blossoms I was not told about. This is their longer life. When Handel had his breakdown, he was, according to my opera-loving mother, the ideal man in that state. Honorable, loving the world he could no longer be a part of, even if the world was a place of continual war. I have been reading recently an essay by one of my Suffolk neighbors on the Latirus maritimus, the sea pea, and how war helped the plant survive. Mines had been placed along our beaches to protect the country from invasion, and this resulted in an abundance of rough green carpets of sea peas with fat and sturdy leaves, thanks to the lack of human traffic. Thus the resurrection of the almost extinct sea pea, a happy vegetable of peace. I am attracted to these surprising liaisons, such sutras of cause and effect, as I had once linked a farce, Trouble in Paradise, with the secret transportation of nitroglycerin into the city of London during the war, or seen a girl I knew loosen a ribbon from her hair in order to dive into a forest pool where bouncing bombs had once been conceived and tested. We lived through a time when events that appeared far-flung were neighbors. Just as I still wonder whether Olive Lawrence, who later taught me and my sister to walk fearlessly into a night forest, ever felt her handful of days and nights along the coast of the English Channel was the highlight of her life. Few knew of her work during that period. She did not mention it in her book or on the television documentary I watched as an adult. There were so many like her, who were content in the modesty of their wartime skills. She was not just an ethnographer, Stetch, my mother had spat out scornfully, more willing to tell me of Olive than of what she herself had done. Viola, are you Viola? I used to whisper to myself, slowly discovering who my mother was on the second floor of that building I worked in. We order our lives with barely held stories, as if we have been lost in a confusing landscape, gathering what was invisible and unspoken. Rachel, the wren, and I, a stitch. Sewing it all together in order to survive, incomplete, ignored like the sea pea on those mined beaches during the war. The greyhound is next to me. He lowers his heavy, bony head onto my hand, as if I were still that 15-year-old boy. But where is the sister, who offered only that indirect farewell to me with a puppet-like wave, using the small hand of her child? or the young girl I might one day catch sight of, picking up a playing card on the street, and rush after to ask, "Pearl, are you Pearl? Did your father and mother teach you to do that? For luck?" Before Sam Malachite gathered me up from white paint on my last day there, I washed some of Rose's clothes and dried them outside on the grass. A few I stretched over bushes. Whatever she had been wearing when she was killed had been taken away. I brought out an ironing board and ironed a checkered shirt she was fond of, its collar, the cuffs she always rolled up. The shirt had never witnessed this heat or pressure before. Then the rest of the shirts. I laid a thin cloth over the blue cardigan she wore that disguised her thinness, and pressed the iron onto it lightly, at half heat. I took the cardigan and the shirts to her room, and hung them in the cupboard, and came downstairs. I walked loudly along the nightingale floor, closed the doors, and left. This is Steve West. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Warlight by Michael Ndaachi. This program was directed by Lisa Wattstein. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright, 2018, by Michael Ndaachi. Production copyright, 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.